This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Last year, AMC's Mad Men made TV history as the first basic cable series to win the Emmy for Outstanding Drama Series. Last weekend, it made history again by repeating that victory. Today, we'll listen back to Terry's interviews with writer-producer Matthew Weiner, who created Mad Men, and with two stars of the show, John Hamm and John Slattery. Mad Men is set in the early 60s at the fictional advertising agency Sterling Cooper, run by white Protestant men who drink, smoke, and womanize. The show revolves around the ad campaigns the agency comes up with and the personal lives of the people who work at the agency. Terry spoke with Matthew Weiner, creator of Mad Men, last year, and with John Hamm and co-star John Slattery, who plays ad executive Roger Sterling. They'll join the conversation in a few minutes. Matthew Weiner was an executive producer and writer for HBO's The Sopranos before moving on to Mad Men. Last year's conversation with Terry began with a clip from season two, a key one in the ongoing development of Peggy Olson, the character played by Elizabeth Moss. The agency is working on an ad campaign for Playtex bras, which has been emphasizing comfort, but is considering playing to women's fantasies, like its rival, Maidenform. Kinsey, a young associate, suggests that they play to the idea that all women see themselves as either a Jackie, Jackie Kennedy, or a Marilyn, Marilyn Monroe. Peggy, who has risen from secretary to copywriter, isn't so sure.
I don't know if all women are a Jackie or a Marilyn. Maybe men see them that way.
Bras are for men. Women want to see themselves the way men see them.
You're a Jackie or a Marilyn. A line and a curve. Nothing goes better together.
Which do you think I am?
Gertrude Stein.
I would say you're more classical. Hellenic.
Irene Dunn.
Oh, I love Irene Dunn.
Peggy, you're going to have company on this. Congratulations, Kinsey. Forced your way onto an accountant.
Matthew Weiner, welcome to Fresh Air.
It's great to be here, Terry.
And we'll meet John Hamm and John Slattery in a second. Let's start with the scene that we just heard. You know, it's all these men deciding what will make women buy a bra and assuming that they know.
Yeah, exactly.
What made you think about using a bra campaign?
There was this idea from the beginning that we were going to talk about pantyhose, which had just come out and really kind of revolutionized everything because they were preferred by working women and by women in general, but they were really reviled by men and didn't catch on right away, and they were very expensive. And then we started talking about the, you know, most products, consumer products, are bought by women. And, of course, most people in advertising are men. And there is an idea where you start to realize that the way that women perceive themselves is going to be dictated by men if that's the marketing campaign. And, of course, Peggy has put on all of the campaigns as they would do, you know, find a woman to deal with food and home-related things and underwear. But at the same time, her opinion is not really as valuable as the men. So the bra just became a perfect sort of example. And we had established that Playtex was one of their clients. And, you know, I'm always interested in where's the boundary at which point where men can stop speaking for women.
But in a way, bras are like the invisible star of the show because a lot of the actresses seem to be wearing those kind of pointy padded bullet bras that were a mainstay of Hollywood in the 50s and early 60s.
Well, yeah, they are. I mean, Janie Bryant, our costume designer, I mean, I insisted that everything be accurate. But what we started talking about is that the silhouette of a woman's body, they could change it every year as the styles changed by just altering the underwear. Now it's all determined by exercise. I wrote it into the show. Just the actresses would have to go to the bathroom and you'd have to have 25 minutes. And you're like, what is going on? What is going on? And they're like, you do not know what is going on down there. There's so much stuff to take off and put on. And it's really about taking whatever body you have and physically molding it into the silhouette that was in style at that time.
What was the germ of the idea for Mad Men? What came to you first?
The first thing that came to me is that I was interested in doing something about – there's two things. One was the period, and that was a germ that I had separately. I sort of wanted to do something about the office, like – the executive suite office, Cash McCall, those movies, patterns that I had knew from the 50s and early 60s. But then I wanted to do something about what I consider to be the people who run the country, who were raised in the Great Depression and had childhoods that were kind of dark And I was interested in identity and men and what where we are, who we look up to, how are we supposed to behave now? There's no model for us. And I just kept digging back further and further and finding that there's never been a model. And I was really most interested in that character of Don. That's the germ of the idea.
My guest is Matthew Weiner. He's the creator of the AMC series Mad Men, and he's also written and directed episodes of the series. And in a moment, we'll be hearing from two of the stars of the show, John Hamm and John Slattery. The last episode of season one has one of my favorite moments from the series. And this is an episode, Matthew, that you wrote and directed. And in this episode, Don Draper has put together a presentation for one of the clients that they're trying to land, and it's Kodak. And Kodak has this new slide and slide projection system where the slides are all on a wheel, and they're calling it the wheel. And Draper's pitching them an ad campaign and a concept for the ad campaign. And in the scene midway through his pitch, he starts showing slides. And the slides happen to be slides of his own family moments, some of his most warm family moments, him nuzzling with his wife when they were younger, one of his children when they were an infant, really nostalgic scenes like that. And in the meantime, his own family life is actually in a lot of trouble. So I'd like you to talk about writing this scene, why you chose the slides as, you know, this, like, slide carousel as the object you wanted to write the ad campaign for, and if you had to get permission from Kodak to do it.
We did not get Kodak's permission, although it's an amazing ad for a product that no one's interested in anymore. What happened is that I knew that I wanted to tell this story about nostalgia, and I knew that I wanted to show that Don, the character, has realized that his brother, who has come back to him, has killed himself. And that he has estranged himself from his family, and he's there with his family slides. But what I wanted to do was I wanted to get this idea of nostalgia in there, and I actually, my advertising consultant, Josh Weltman, I'm like, what product can I use here? And I kept thinking about, Kodak has always had such an incredibly wonderful, sentimental ad campaign, Kleenex has them, whatever. But I asked him, what came out that year? What can you find? And he comes in and he says, you're not going to believe this. And he mentions it to me because I always wanted Don to be showing personal pictures in this thing. I didn't know it could be a slide projector. I thought it might be a camera or something. And it was like an explosion in my brain when he told me about the carousel. And I was like, this is perfect. And it was also kind of a surprise because it fit into everything we've been talking about that season too, because everything in advertising at that point was about technology. The new technology was the way to sell the product. And so you knew that Don had a problem with technology. He wasn't interested in space travel. He wasn't interested in going to the moon. He wasn't interested in a lot of things that were all about that. So it was a perfect it's one of those – a lot of times it happens on the show where you have an idea and it just works out. And I don't know how to explain it, but we've been very lucky that way.
So here's the scene from Mad Men featuring John Hamm as Don Draper. And remember, midway through this presentation, he's going to start showing slides from his own family moments.
My first job, I was in-house at a fur company with this old pro copywriter, Greek, named Teddy. And Teddy told me the most important idea in advertising is new. Creates an itch. You simply put your product in there as a kind of calamine lotion. But he also talked about a deeper bond with the product. Nostalgia. It's delicate, but potent. Sweetheart. Teddy told me that in Greek, nostalgia literally means the pain from an old wound. It's a twinge in your heart, far more powerful than memory alone. This device isn't a spaceship. It's a time machine. Goes backwards, forwards. It takes us to a place where we ache to go again. It's not called the wheel. It's called the carousel. It lets us travel the way a child travels. Round and around, and back home again. To a place where we know we are loved.
That's John Hamm as Don Draper in a scene from the AMC series Mad Men. And John Hamm, welcome to the conversation.
Thank you, Terry.
That's a great scene. You're so terrific in it. It's a really heartbreaking scene because your character knows he's having such trouble in his personal life as he's showing these wonderful slides and talking about nostalgia. John Hamm, tell us how you found out about this role and first went on the audition for it.
It was, there's this mythical season in Los Angeles called pilot season. So I had gone out on several pilot auditions and gotten fairly far on them, and then something happened and I didn't get it. But this one script came, and I read it, and I thought, well, this is for AMC. They don't make television. They show old movies. But I read it, and I said, I have to be in this project at some point. I have to do something on this. This is so good. And I basically had to start at the very bottom. I was I didn't know the casting directors, and they didn't know me. So they wanted to do what's curiously called a pre-read with me, which is you meet the casting directors, and they read you and decide if they want to sort of take you to the next level. So I started literally at the very bottom of the process and worked my way up from there.
Matthew Weiner, why did you hire John Hamm in your leading role as Don Draper?
Well, first of all, there's something that John is leaving out, which people may not know, which is that audition, when you get to a certain point in your career, you really don't expect to audition even anymore. And certainly for a leading role like that, you do expect it. But there's really a hierarchy of who has to audition and what it is. And this thing was so important to me that I was like, I will not hire anybody who won't audition. So everyone had to audition. And the casting directors knew that. And they knew that John was the guy. And they wanted him to be perfect when I saw him. And what happened was he came in and literally his first audition, he left. And I said, that's the guy. He has this incredible intelligence. And you could see it right away. He understood everything that was going on there without any direction. And he had this presence that was both, it was an old-fashioned leading man quality. You don't even see these people anymore. You know, there's many more guys like Seth Rogen getting the girl, you know, nowadays than like John Hamm. Not that there's anything wrong with that. I mean, I'm much more of a Seth Rogen type. But in my fantasy, you know, of who this man was, and I told them I wanted James Garner. You know, and they're like, well, you know, he can't play it. And John came in, and there's also a depth to John. There's something about his eyes and his intelligence that I just felt, well, this is not a glib ad man. This is a man who has lived, who's an adult, who has some secrets, who has a heart, who understands women. I felt all of that from just watching him audition the very first time. And I have it on record because I said it out loud to a lot of people. And then it was just a matter, because we were with a new network, it was a matter of just trying to sell this person who was not famous as the star of the show. And I can say quite honestly, and John knows this too, that I basically told them that I would not do the show if John was not the lead.
Matthew Weiner and John Hamm speaking to Terry Gross. Last Sunday, Mad Men won the Emmy for Outstanding Drama Series for the second year in a row. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2008 conversation with Mad Men creator Matthew Weiner and star John Hamm. Co-star John Slattery, who plays Roger Sterling, is about to join the conversation.
I want to bring John Slattery into the conversation, and John Slattery plays Roger Sterling, who is the son of the late co-founder of the advertising agency Sterling Cooper. So now he's, you know, like one of the partners of it. And he's of a generation, like one generation older than Don Draper. in the series. And in this scene, I'm going to play a scene with Roger Sterling and Don Draper. So in this scene, Sterling has just walked into Draper's office with a bottle of liquor and is sitting down, and they're kind of comparing generational differences. And the scene starts with John Slattery as Roger Sterling.
I bet daily friendship with that bottle attracts more people to advertising than any salary you could dream of.
That's why I got in.
So enjoy it.
Doing my best here.
Oh, did not. You don't know how to drink, your whole generation. You drink for the wrong reasons. My generation, we drink because it's good. Because it feels better than unbuttoning your collar. Because we deserve it. We drink because it's what men do.
What about shaky hands? I see a lot of that, too, with you boys.
No joke. Your kind, with your gloomy thoughts and your worries, you're all busy licking some imaginary wound.
Not all imaginary.
Yeah, boo-hoo.
Maybe I'm not as comfortable being powerless as you are.
Pardon?
That's John Hamm and John Slattery in a scene from Mad Men. John Slattery, welcome to the conversation.
Thanks, Terry.
How did you find out about Mad Men, and how did you end up auditioning for it?
I was in New York doing a play, and I was sent the script. And I've said this before, and Matt hasn't corrected me, so I'm going to stick with this version, which is that I read it thinking that they needed the character of Don Draper, which I was, of course, very happy about. I thought, you know, usually it's some 65-year-old guy that they send me a script for. So I prepared the part of Don Draper.
This is because your hair is gray, right?
That's right. That's among other things. So I worked on it and went in and read with Matt and Alan Taylor, who directed the pilot. And I think I'd gone through it maybe twice. I think they actually had me go through it again before telling me, here's the thing. We have that guy. We want you to play this other guy, of which there was not as much.
Well, I hate to tell John this on the air. Beth Bowling and Kim Misha are casting directors. I wanted him to play Roger from the beginning, and they told me there was no way he would come in and read for that part. Yeah. And I said, we'll get him in here. And he came in and started reading Don, and it was a surprise to me, too. And all I did was keep working with him as I figured out, like, how do I tell him I want him to play this other part, which was really for a man much older than John. But I brought it down to a different age. And you know, the tough part was not just getting John to do the pilot, but afterwards just telling him, promising him, which I guess people do a lot in show business, mm-hmm. but promising him that I would take care of this character and that he was very important to me.
We're listening to a conversation with Mad Men creator Matthew Weiner and actors John Hamm and John Slattery. Mad Men is set in the early 1960s. Terry asked John Hamm, who stars in the show, how he got into character for the period.
I had always sort of been a fan of that period and the art and the literature and the cinema that came out of it, you know, anything in the sort of Jack Lemmon, Walter Matthau crowd, and of course the Billy Wilder movies. And just on a more personal level, my father was sort of a big deal businessman in St. Louis in this time, in the 50s and 60s, and he worked for a company that his grandfather and his father had owned. So I literally just looking through old photo albums, and I could see, I mean, here was this guy, this man who was the sort of master of his domain, and the sort of ease which with he moved through this world. St. Louis is obviously a much smaller pond than Madison Avenue in New York City, but that kind of largesse and ease was a big part of what informed my interpretation of Don.
I got to ask you a question about that. Your character of Don has a way of kind of crossing his legs. It's a kind of power position for him. The way he crosses his legs is like, I own extra space around me. I own all the space around my body. Did your father kind of sit that way?
Yeah, he was a big guy. He was about 6'3", and he owned the space he was in. He was very friendly, very gregarious. Very fun, very funny guy, but he also had a lot of sadness in his life. My father met my mother, who was a secretary, and they got married. But my mother was my father's second wife. His first wife died at a very young age. And my mother, his second wife, also died at a very young age. So this is a man who had a tremendous amount of sadness for being in such a sort of powerful and elevated position in his life. He did have a lot of sadness. So I didn't have to look too far to find any kind of inspiration for this guy. And you know, my father passed away when I was 20, so it's a drag that he doesn't get a chance to see this, because I think he would really enjoy the result.
Well, I want to thank you all for talking with us, and congratulations on the show. Thanks very much, John Slattery, John Hamm, and Matthew Weiner.
Thanks so much for having us,
Terry. This is very exciting. Thanks.
Matthew Weiner, John Hamm, and John Slattery speaking to Terry Gross last year. Last Sunday, AMC's Mad Men won the Emmy as Outstanding Drama Series for the second year in a row. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air. After box office hits with Roger and Me, Fahrenheit 9/11, and Sicko, and an Oscar for Bowling for Columbine, Michael Moore returns with Capitalism, A Love Story, a critical look at the business of America. Business. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Say what you will about Michael Moore. He's a successful left-wing carnival barker in a culture that mostly rewards right-wing carnival barkers. Yes, he's been caught fudging facts, but he doesn't just spew partisan talking points. He's out there, on the street, amassing evidence. His new cinematic circus, Capitalism, A Love Story, is the film he's been building to for two decades. It's sprawling, scattershot, and sniggering. It's brazenly one-sided. Yet it's riveting. His other films focused on symptoms. This one tackles what he sees as the disease. Let's start with his conclusion. Quote, "Capitalism is an evil, and you cannot regulate evil." That's enough to give anyone pause, especially in light of the sorry history of other political and economic systems. He has a less controversial case when he attacks those who portray the connection between capitalism and democracy as sibling close, united under the umbrella of the Constitution. One of Moore's stunts is a trip to the Capitol Rotunda to examine the document. After a Wall Street Journal editor tells Moore that capitalism is more important than democracy, the filmmaker quotes the Founding Fathers on the dangers to democracy of an unregulated market. He also has Jesus on the record denouncing material wealth. As usual, Moore scores most points with satire. He redubs an old Bible movie so that Jesus refuses to heal a cripple because of a, quote, pre-existing condition. I wouldn't use the term documentary to describe this film. It's a barbed comic monologue with big jolts of pathos. Moore uses a daddy knows best tone, borrowed from 50s documentaries. This, kiddies, is how our society really works. Some people hate that condescending tone, but I like it. I think it's apt. Moore is a kind of Mr. Rogers with 200 extra pounds and a Che Guevara t-shirt instead of a cardigan. As for content, Moore ranges far and wide, although rarely very deep. He begins with foreclosures on poor people and gives a quick sketch of predatory lending. He draws comparisons between the fall of the Roman Empire and our American century. He makes the case that Ronald Reagan and his corporate allies began dismantling regulations in a way that amounted to a coup d'etat.
See that guy standing next to the president? You know, the one that looks like a butler? His name was Don Regan, the chairman of Merrill Lynch, the richest and biggest retail brokerage firm in the world. He took the key position of Treasury Secretary so he could enact the tax cuts that the rich wanted. Regan then became White House Chief of Staff as the president started to fade.
Then they should give the president what 43 governors have, a line item veto. And
Who tells the president to speed it up? The man from Merrill Lynch, that's who. Things in America would never be the same again. The country would now be run like a corporation.
We're going to turn the bull loose.
It got worse, says Moore, under George W. Bush, who took a chainsaw to Wall Street regulations. That's not my metaphor. or Moore's, Bush officials and lobbyists posed with a chainsaw for a magazine cover, setting the stage for what Moore calls the greatest wave of white-collar crime in American history. He doesn't exempt Democrats either. Bill Clinton also unleashes the Wall Street Bull. But while Moore rejoices at the triumph of democracy he says was Obama's election, he doesn't note the bailout goes on unabated. Among Moore's more appalling segments is one in which he recounts instances in which for-profit businessmen assumed roles traditionally played by government, like the private Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania juvenile correction facility that allegedly paid millions in kickbacks to judges who'd put away teens for minor infractions. Moore makes one detour that's exploitive. After a segment on blue-chip companies that earn millions secretly taking out life insurance policies on employees, he introduces a family in which the mother, a Walmart worker, died of an asthma attack, and the company collected $80,000. The children read "We miss you" letters to their dead mom and weep. But what's the context? She wasn't failed by the health care system. He moves in on the crying kids like a ghoul. In the final sequence, Moore pretends to try to make citizens' arrests on Wall Street and puts crime scene tape around the stock exchange. On one level, groan. On another, no one else seems about to make arrests. Maybe the image of Michael Moore as sheriff would scare Wall Street straight.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hirschfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our next guest, singer-songwriter Nick Cave, is famous for his dark songs and for his rough voice, which brings out all the dark colors in those songs. But he also writes novels, which, no surprise, are somewhat dark and rough, as well as playfully twisted. His second book, The Death of Bunny Monroe, a novel, has just been published. The character in the title, Bunny Monroe, is a door-to-door lotion salesman in England. At the start of the book, he's making the rounds, seducing a string of beautiful housewives. But before long, Bunny's life, like the book, takes a much more somber turn. Nick Cave grew up in Australia and now lives in England. He wrote the screenplay for the bloody western The Proposition and co-wrote the scores for that film and for another western, the 2007 movie The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford. Terry spoke with Nick Cave last year when his CD Dig Lazarus Dig was released. Here's the title track.
Larry made his nest up in the autumn branches, built from nothing but high hopes and thin air. He collected up some baby blasted mothers. They took their chances, and for a while they lived quite happily up there. He came from New York City, man, but he couldn't take the pace, and thought it was like a dog-eat-dog world. Then he went to San Francisco, spent a year in outer space, with a sweet little San Franciscan girl. I can hear my mother wailing and a whole lot of scraping of chairs. I don't know what it is, but there's definitely something going on upstairs.
Lazarus, dig yourself. Lazarus, dig
Nick Cave, welcome to Fresh Air. Tell me the story behind writing that song. What made you think about writing a song that refers to Lazarus?
I think I was getting some kind of revenge on my religious upbringing. I was particularly, as a child, it worried me a lot, that particular story, that Christ's greatest miracle was actually bringing someone back from the dead. And that kind of, as a child, creeped me out somewhat, to be honest. It didn't exactly traumatize me, but it felt kind of nice to sort of redress that in some kind of way and write a song about it. So I basically took the biblical Lazarus and dropped him in New York City and kind of a half comical look at what would happen to him in the contemporary world.
You said that you see the song as revenge for your religious upbringing. So many of your songs refer, you know, have biblical references or references to Jesus or God, and some in a more straightforward way, some in a more elliptical way, some in a comic way, some in a cynical way, some in a searching or loving way. Was that always true of your songs, or is this something more recent?
I think it was always true. I can remember as very young writing poetry, and the stories from the Bible always played there was always a strong element of that, even in my very, very early poetry, which I'm not going to
recite for us
recite
now.
Recite for on radio. But there was a kind of fascination. There was a fascination when I was a choir boy at school and at the cathedral that I went to, and I had to go to church maybe three times a week for about 3 or 4 years. And I was actually kind of interested, especially in the biblical stories.
How old were you when you started reading the Bible?
I kind of got into the Bible because I went to art school and became very interested in religious painting. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that was because I understood the stories. I knew what those paintings were about, and I took a great interest in them. And then I think after that I started to kind of read, particularly the Old Testament, a lot. And I did that for quite a few years, and that had a huge influence over the way I saw the world, really, and also the songs that I wrote at that time. You know, and then I kind of gave that up and looked at the New Testament after a while.
So what are the differences?
But it's only kind of one element of what I'm doing, really.
But what's the difference between your Old Testament and your New Testament songs?
Well, I think that there's a kind of more humanistic approach to the characters in my songs, more a forgiving approach to the narratives.
Well, I want to play another track from your new CD, Dig Lazarus Dig, and this one also has a Jesus reference to it. It's called Jesus of the Moon. It's a beautiful song. I mean, it's a love song. Would you talk a little bit about writing this song?
Well, you know, I mean, I think that this particular record, Dig Lazarus Dig, despite the title, is probably the least obsessed or religiously obsessed record I made in years. It's really not about that. And there is a song called Jesus of the Moon, really, but I just felt it was a kind of nifty way of describing a sleeping woman and a sleeping woman that I was kind of departing from. It just felt good to describe her in that way. But it's I guess the reason why it's on the record, this particular song, even though it's not really a ballad record, and this is very much a ballad, is that it felt like, to me, a kind of fresh take for me on the leaving a woman type of song that I often write. There seemed to be a kind of rebirth in the whole thing that sounded kind of nice to me.
Oh, I think it's a great song. Let's hear it. This is Jesus of the Moon from Nick Cave's new CD, which is called Dig Lazarus Dig.
I stepped out of the St. James Hotel. I left you behind, curled up like a child. Change is gonna come. The door whispered shut. I walked on down the high-windowed hall. You lay sleeping on the unmade bed. The weatherman on the television in the St. James Hotel said that the rains are gonna come. And I stepped out on the streets.
all sparkling clean in the early morning dew. Maybe it was you and maybe it was me. You came on like a punch in the heart. You lying there with the light on your hair like a Jesus of the moon, a Jesus of the planets and the stars.
That's Nick Cave's song, Jesus of the Moon, from his new CD, Dig Lazarus, Dig. You live in England now, but you grew up in Australia. Would you describe the town you grew up in?
It's called Wangaratta. I mean, it's about 18,000 people, and it was, but with very much a kind of small town mentality. And to be honest, I was quite happy to get out of there.
Because?
Well, it was very restrictive, and all the stuff that I find difficult with Australia is amplified a thousandfold in these small towns. And that's if you kind of stick your head too high above the parapet, it gets lopped off, if you understand what I mean. Everyone has to be kind of the same, you know, and hunker down. And I wasn't kind of interested in that. It was quite difficult for me. It was quite difficult for my family in general, actually.
It was hard for me to imagine you fitting into a place like that.
Well, I didn't. And I got sent to Melbourne when I was about 12. It just wasn't working out in this town for me.
I got sent to
a boarding school in Melbourne.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And was that's a more metropolitan place?
Well, a more metropolitan place. I mean, that also had its problems as well. But there's a lot about the growing up in the country that I loved, especially as a child, and my childhood was spent, you know, down by the river and all of that sort of stuff, and it was very free and very happy, actually. But as a teenager, you know, around that time in Wangaratta, was very difficult.
Did you have access, either in Wangaratta or in Melbourne, to the movies and music and books that eventually meant a lot to you?
Well, I did. You know, I mean, when I was 9 or 10, we got the Johnny Cash show, for example, in Australia. That was shown in Australia, mm-hmm, on a weekly basis. So I watched that, and that had a huge impact on me. My brother, who was 4 years older, was very into music and listened to a lot of kind of great music, and so I was very much influenced by what he listened to. A lot of English progressive music, you know. So, you know, I was around music a lot.
What impact did Johnny Cash have on you?
Well, I remember distinctly watching the Johnny Cash show and my ideas about what music could be changing. You know, the gears kind of shifted, and something happened with the whole chemistry. My whole chemistry kind of changed watching that. There was something that I didn't really understand then, I guess, but that was so kind of edgy about that particular show.
And Johnny Cash himself, you know, in addition to his just incredibly moving voice, he was able to sing both about the spiritual and do really convincing murder ballads and revenge ballads.
Yeah, I mean, the way I looked at him when I was young was that he was an outlaw. You know, I'm talking about a young boy who was 9 or 10 watching this kind of stuff. But he seemed like that. It seemed like that rock and roll or music could be an outlaw kind of thing that operated on the periphery of society in some way.
Nick Cave speaking to Terry Gross last year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2008 interview with singer-songwriter Nick Cave. He's just published his second book, The Death of Bunny Monroe, a novel.
If you don't mind my bringing this up, your father was killed by a car accident when you were 19.
Yeah.
I'm wondering what it did to your sense of justice, of there being a God in this world, of your sense of vulnerability and impermanence, to have something like that happen when you were relatively young.
Well, I think it had a huge impact. You know, my world became decidedly different almost overnight. It changed from being a relatively safe world to being a very unsure place. And I pretty much left, You know, I lived at home with my mother, but I pretty much left home after that and went what we Australians say is as overseas, which is to England.
He had been an English teacher. Was he an influence on you in terms of writing or the books that you read?
I mean, he was a massive influence. You know, he was a smart guy and a very well read, and you know, and I'd be sitting around at home and reading something or other, and he would say, you know, I'd be reading a crime novel, let's say, and if he'd say, well, look, if you really want to read a great murder scene, here, check this out, and he'd kind of read the murder scene in Crime and Punishment to me. Or, you know, he read me the first chapter of Lolita, which had a huge impact over me. I mean, for many reasons. Not just in that he turned me on to a lot of great literature, but I kind of saw the effect that literature had on him, and you know, and kind of wanted some of that.
And your mother was a librarian. Did she choose books for you?
Well, not in the same way. But really, I'm even though my father was very much the flamboyant one. And the one, you know, the family would kind of crane towards when he would be talking at the dinner table. I'm very much like my mother, actually. Most of my ideals and stuff really come from my mother.
Now, we talked a little earlier about growing up in Australia. And one of the things about Australia is that, you know, the white people there basically came to start a penal colony. And you wrote the screenplay for the film The Proposition, which relates to that. And you wrote the score. You co-wrote the score for it, too. So we're going to hear the title clip, so to speak, the title scene in which the police captain actually makes the proposition. But set the scene for us. This is very early on in the film. Just summarize for us what's brought us to this point.
Well, the film opens with the kind of obliteration of the Burns gang by the police in a horrible kind of gunfight. And the two brothers, there's three brothers, but two of them have been captured. Mikey, which is the little one, and Charlie, which is the main character of the film. And the police chief presents these two brothers with a proposition in regard to Arthur Burns, a kind of renegade brother who has departed from the gang some time before and is living up in the hills. And what you will hear now is the proposition.
I wish to present you with a proposition. I know where Arthur Burns is. It is a godforsaken place. Blacks won't go there, not the trackers, not even my own men. I suppose in time the bounty hunters will get him. But I have other plans. I aim to bring him down. I aim to show that he is a man like any other. I aim to hurt him.
When you're ready, sir.
And what will most hurt him? Well, I thought long and hard about that. And I have realized, Mr. Burns, that I must become a little more inventive in my methods. Now, don't speak, Mr. Burns. Listen to me now. Don't say a word. I suppose I told you there was a way to save your little brother, Mikey, from the noose. Suppose I gave you a horse and a gun. Suppose, Mr. Burns, I was to give both you and your young brother, Mikey, here a pardon.
Suppose I said that I could give you the chance to expunge the guilt beneath which you so clearly labor. Suppose I gave you till Christmas. I suppose you tell me what it is I want from you.
You want me to kill my brother?
I want you to kill your brother. Arthur Burns is a monster. An abomination. You were right to part company with him.
It's Ray Winstone in a scene from The Proposition, which was written by my guest Nick Cave, who also co-wrote the score. That must be pretty exciting to write the screenplay and the music for a movie. It's a very brutal film, and again relates to the origins of Australia as a penal colony. Since you are interested in like murder ballads and revenge and songs about those themes, are you particularly interested in the penal colony origins of your country of origin?
I mean, we all are. All Australians are, to a degree. I mean, for a long time we were, as a country, it was considered a kind of shameful aspect to our heritage. You know the fact that we come from colonial stock and that we were prisoners initially and criminals. But I think that that's kind of largely changed, and we're more kind of accepting of that these days. But I was actually approached by the director to write this screenplay because he couldn't manage to get he wanted to make an Australian Western, just couldn't manage to get a script that he liked or that was Australian enough actually. But I was just very interested in writing a script anyway, just to see if I could do that. And I was lucky enough to be presented with the idea by John Hillcoat about something that I knew a little bit about.
Thank you so much for talking with us. It's really been great to talk with you.
Thanks very much.
Nick Cave speaking to Terry Gross last year. The singer-songwriter's second book, The Death of Bunny Monroe, a novel, has just been published.